This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 27th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, the FCC votes to review the wireless industry, including competition and consumer rights. It's the fourth anniversary of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. We'll look at recovery efforts and what still needs to be done.
There's a number of things that we think can happen to straighten things out, and that starts with recognizing our internally displaced persons in this country.
And we go to El Salvador, where journalists and anti-mining activists face death threats just weeks after an activist was brutally murdered. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Another U.S. drone attack in Pakistan has hit a Taliban hideout, killing at least four. And the Pakistani Interior Minister told the BBC that foreign al-Qaeda fighters were beginning to leave the country. Despite this, a suicide bomb exploded today in Landi Kotal, a city along the northern border with Afghanistan. Nathan Moore reads for FSRN's Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
A suicide bomber attacked members of a Landi Kotal tribal militia called the Qadisar Force as they sat down for a post-sunset meal to break the fast of Ramadan. The Qadisar Force performed security duties on the Pakistan-Afghan border, but they're famous locally for taking bribes from smugglers and charging Afghan people who want to cross. Local people found at least 20 dead and 17 others seriously injured. Witnesses say seven people were completely mutilated by the blast. Farad Shinawari, a Landi Kotal-based journalist, spoke to FSRN from a local hospital.
I saw bodies without heads, while some were without hands and legs. After the attack, Kasadar and locals gathered the flesh and bones in a sack. One injured man said, a young man approached the barracks close to the checkpoint and offered some cold drinks. And then he blew himself up with a strong explosion.
Despite the Qadisar Force's bad reputation among tribal people, nearly 100 locals gathered in the hospital to donate blood and take the injured to a better-equipped hospital in Peshawar. The Abdul Azim group of militants has accepted responsibility for the attack. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, I'm Nathan Moore, FSRN.
Argentina is debating media reform. A new bill introduced by the president today could mean greater community access to the airwaves. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
For the first time in nearly three decades, Argentina is revising legislation that currently bans community groups from getting broadcast licenses. President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner sent the reform legislation to Congress and announced the measure in a televised conference at the government palace. The new legislation will reserve one-third of the airwaves for nonprofit groups, ensuring that community associations and universities are guaranteed access to licenses. The current broadcasting law was passed in 1980 by the military dictatorship. It provided private media holders large profits, while promising support for the dictatorship from media outlets and silencing journalists from reporting on the systematic rights abuses taking place in the nation. More than 300 unions, community media organizations, and human rights groups helped develop the new bill. And as the president announced the reforms, hundreds marched to Congress in support of the legislation. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
The South African government is investigating a demonstration on Wednesday by soldiers from the country's military. A large strike for better salaries and working conditions turned violent. From South Africa, FSRN's Davison Makanga reports.
Defense Minister Lindiwe Sisulu described the incident as anarchy and a threat to national security. Several soldiers were injured as police fired rubber bullets to disperse close to 1,000 rioting soldiers at President Jacob Zuma's Union Buildings offices in the capital, Pretoria. The soldiers who are demanding 30% salary increase went ahead with the protest despite a court order against such action. The South African National Defense Union has distanced itself from the rioting members. Two soldiers who were arrested are expected to appear before the Tough Army Tribunal. Salary protests are swelling in South Africa as the ordinary people feel the pinch of the economic recession. The government last month averted a potentially damaging strike by correctional services workers. Davison Makanga, FSRN, Cape Town, South Africa.
FDIC-insured banks have lost a total of $3.7 billion in the last quarter, according to figures released today. Just 1 year ago, the banks actually made money to the tune of $4.8 billion. But as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, one of the reasons for the bank's troubles may be a dubious indication of the economic stability of the people.
The main cause for poor bank performance is that fewer people are able to pay back their loans. The amount of loans banks are unable to collect has nearly doubled since this time last year. This is the main reason the FDIC added 111 financial institutions to their problem bank list in the last quarter. And poor bank performance is putting a strain on the institution, which insures up to $250,000 of deposited money for every consumer. But Sheila Baer, chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, says not to worry. The consumer protection will not go away. In a statement, she said, quote, "No insured depositor has ever lost a penny, and no one ever will. The FDIC can borrow up to $500 billion from the Treasury if necessary." Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Today, the Federal Communications Commission approved an investigation that will look at ways to regulate cell phone operators, wireless internet providers, and other sectors of the wireless communications industry. The focus will be on three key areas: innovation, competition, and consumer protection. Some consumer protection advocates say it's about time. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The FCC will do an inquiry into the wireless industry, which includes cell phones and mobile internet providers. FCC Commissioner Michael Copps says regulation always needs to play a part.
The wireless industry deserves recognition and credit for how much it has accomplished. There should be no doubt that facilitating further innovation in wireless technologies and services is absolutely crucial to our nation's prosperity and well-being in the digital age. We look to industry for much of that, but visionary public policy should always be the handmaiden of private enterprise.
The FCC will look at what other countries are doing, what role consolidation is playing, and how the FCC can do a better job in protecting against interference. So far, the FCC has not provided much wireless regulation at all. Commissioner Robert McDowell wants to keep it that way.
Where we go from here is not yet clear, but where we have been is clear. The Commission's long-standing policy to allow competitive market forces rather than command and control regulations to foster the development of and investment in wireless networks and services has led to remarkable advances. Thus, I hope that we will proceed with care, mindful that any future action we consider should aim to attract more private investment capital rather than deter it.
McDowell is one of two Republican commissioners on the FCC. Commissioners are appointed by the president for five-year terms. The FCC will also look at competition among wireless networks and consumer protection issues. Ben Scott is a policy director for the media reform advocacy group Free Press. He says the inquiry is coming at the right time.
For the last several years, particularly in the wireless market, the FCC has basically said, oh, it's competitive, everything is fine. Nothing to see here, move right along, and they haven't made any kind of regulatory intervention, nothing on consumer protection, nothing on pro-competition, nothing on mandating sort of openness or an open market for speech and commerce on the mobile internet. All those issues are very important, and they may require regulation.
Consumer complaints include not being able to understand charges on wireless bills, having to sign onto long contracts, and not having enough information when choosing a wireless service. But it might be a good time for consumers to gain some more rights. Scott with Free Press says a recent economic collapse could draw more support for regulation. But he does see some backlash coming from the telecommunications industry.
Particularly when you have industries that have huge players like AT&T and Verizon, who, in addition to being the largest wireless companies in the country, also happen to be the largest owners of telephone lines in the country. That kind of corporate giantism is what necessitates this kind of inquiry from a federal regulator to make sure that those interests don't gain control over the market and use that power to further their own ends at the expense of the country.
The probe will last for several weeks, and the FCC will then vote on what steps they will take next. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
As the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina approaches, community groups in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast are expressing their frustration at the federal government. 4 years after the hurricane, many local residents say recovery efforts are far from being complete. This week, the Institute for Southern Studies released a survey in which it asked community leaders from the Gulf Coast to grade the federal government and Congress on their role in reconstruction. Participants gave the government a D on most issues related to reconstruction, including categories like helping displaced people return home and revitalizing infrastructure in communities. To take a deeper look at these problems, we're now joined by Trupanya Bonner, the executive director of Moving Forward Gulf Coast. Bonner's organization formed after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita to support and empower the community in rebuilding efforts. Moving Forward has been involved in several reconstruction projects, and they're now leading a campaign to make sure Gulf Coast residents are properly counted in the 2010 census. Mr. Bonner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you guys.
Could you tell us about why the 2010 census is important for Gulf Coast residents?
Yeah, you know, it's important because for Louisianians, they stand to lose one congressional seat and one electoral vote, and there's going to be some serious redistricting happening as a result of the forced depopulation in the Gulf Coast post-Katrina. And so it's important that the Census Bureau hopefully receives more or an additional federal funding to hire more enumerators, but also to participate in a possible field hearing around counting displaced folks who are actively rebuilding, who have been actively rebuilding for the past 4 years, to be counted at their pre-Katrina residence. It's very important to have diaspora folks who've been actively rebuilding and will not be living in their displaced cities a year or two from now to be counted at their pre-Katrina residence. Nearly $300 billion in federal money that's going to come down as a result of the 2010 census count to be distributed to those communities where folks have been actively rebuilding.
Now, a coalition of New Orleans relief organizations called the Greater New Orleans Disaster Recovery Partnership, they recently said that recovery is only halfway through. 4 years after Katrina, how complete would you say the recovery efforts are? How much more is there to go?
I won't necessarily disagree with that claim, but I'll tell you this, that the New Orleans has only received to date 52% of federal funds that was allocated for our recovery, right? Why is that? All right? And so it's only common sense that we've only received half the funds and we're only halfway complete, right? Again, tying this into this upcoming census is crucial because, again, we're talking about nearly $3 billion that can be used for our recovery.
As someone who has seen these reconstruction efforts, how do you feel about the reconstruction policies of President Obama and Congress?
We have yet to see exactly what President Obama is going to do about our recovery. There have been some notable folks that's been picked up by President Obama to join his cabinet that are from our region. But we do hear that Napolitano did say that we're nearly 99% complete, and we disagree with that, right?
After the hurricane and in the days and weeks that followed, there was a lot of discussion that African Americans were the hardest hit by this catastrophe. What about today? Are African Americans still suffering disproportionately when it comes to housing, jobs, and returning home?
Absolutely. We were nearly 60% or so of the population of this city, right? We were down nearly 10 to 12%. Pre-Katrina, the stats were that 55% of renters occupied space in New Orleans, and that's a significant amount of renters. You know, on average, on a national scene, in major cities, you may have 40% that are renters. In New Orleans, we have 55%. The majority of those renters were African Americans. There was no road home plan and no special provisions made for renters. deserves to return.
But what's the situation now? Is that still happening? Is it still difficult for people to return home?
It's still very difficult for renters to return home. Talking about the homeowners, you know, the majority of this population was African Americans, whether you were renters or homeowners, and both are locked out, right, continue to be locked out. So, again, 30,000 folks still have applications on file with the Road Home Program, still hadn't received funds to rebuild their homes. And so, with us losing nearly 10% of our population post-Katrina, we're still struggling to get back to New Orleans.
That was Trepanya Bonner from Moving Forward Gulf Coast. As part of our continuing Katrina anniversary coverage, tune in tomorrow when we'll hear from residents who've been homeless since the storm. You're listening to FSRN. On Labor Day, FSRN brings you a special documentary about an old-fashioned union battle with a twist. We'll introduce you to the people who made your bed and scrubbed your tub the last time you stayed in a hotel, and we'll take you inside a whole new kind of hotel industry that might surprise you.
The workers in the hotel are the people who are cleaning the rooms, serving the food, washing the dishes, and the company can't make a cent without them.
It's not easy, that's what I'm seeing, but it's good to fight until win.
They're supposedly free, you know, secret ballot elections, but they're held inside the hotel and on the company's fixed timeline.
We'll bring you the voices of a fledgling union still fighting for its right to exist. We'll meet housekeepers cleaning twice as many rooms as they can in a day, and union organizers punished with gender humiliation. We'll find out whether hotels are cutting staff because of the recession or to maximize profits. We'll go on the roller coaster ride of fear and triumph with the workers at the Sheraton Crystal City in Northern Virginia. Join us for the FSRN special Labor Day documentary, 16 Rooms, the campaign for a hotel workers union. That's Monday, September 7th on FSRN. FSRN reporter Daniel Denver has been on a road trip across the United States Rust Belt. Denver's looking at creative projects to revitalize the deindustrialized region, an area that has suffered from economic crisis since long before the current recession. Today, Denver's reporting from Cleveland, Ohio, on the soon-to-be-open Evergreen Laundry, a worker-owned enterprise that's part of a larger effort to create jobs by locally channeling spending by the city's big institutions.
So in the laundry, we're going to come in. It's a U-shaped process.
Jim Anderson of Kent State University's Ohio Employee Ownership Center is showing off Cleveland's Evergreen Laundry, slated to open this September. Unlike most laundries, this business is a worker-owned cooperative. Anderson is part of a project to develop employee-owned enterprises in the city's poorest neighborhoods, directing money spent by Cleveland's major institutions into the local economy. According to Anderson, local residents are up for the job.
Many of them are very highly skilled. And in the industrial past, they were employed by companies that supported the local steel industry or other manufacturers in Cleveland before the economic reversals occurred. So there's a lot of folks out there with a lot of skills living in the neighborhoods we're referring to that are going to become candidates or become employee worker owners as we go and create these companies.
Like cities and towns across the Rust Belt, Cleveland has been hit hard by outsourcing, white flight suburbanization, and now the foreclosure crisis. The city of 400,000 lost 45% of its residents over the past 60 years, but some are hoping the development of employee-owned businesses will help staunch the flow. The project was inspired by Spain's renowned Mondragon Cooperative, a sprawling Basque Country employee-owned enterprise that runs grocery stores and a bank and makes everything from kitchen appliances and furniture to forklifts and machinery.
50 years ago, in this Basque region of Spain, a priest and five gentlemen started a worker co-op. And today, in that same region, there's 120 companies. Okay, and 100,000 worker owners. And they've never laid a worker off in 50 years.
Like Mondragon, Evergreen plans to use a portion of profits to seed future worker-owned businesses, including a greenhouse farm. Evergreen laundry workers will start at $10.50 per hour, with health care and a share of future profits, considerably better remuneration than the minimum wage typical in the industry. Evergreen says that it can stay competitive through higher productivity and lower turnover. The laundry will start up with 6 to 8 workers and aims to grow to 50 employees within 3 years.
My name is Keith Parkham, and I'm the first employee of the laundry.
Parkham is the laundry's maintenance worker. Today, the new commercial washer, stretching 36 feet across the main room, is being installed, and Parkham carefully studies the new machine, talking back and forth with the suppliers. He needs to learn exactly how everything works. It'll be his job to fix it.
This right here, this is called the tunnel. This is where the clothes come in and then they get washed. There's 4 different cycles, and we're putting in a tunnel and the press.
In fallen industrial powerhouses like Cleveland, hospitals and universities are some of the only large institutions that can't be moved overseas. Built alongside the area's once massive business wealth, institutions like Case Western Reserve University, university hospitals, and the giant Cleveland Clinic are here to stay. The Evergreen Cooperative wants to direct more of the $3 billion these institutions spend on products and services towards generating community jobs. Much of it has tended to follow the population exodus across the municipal line. India Pierce Lee is Program Director for Neighborhoods, Housing, and Community Development at the Cleveland Foundation, one of the main organizations behind Evergreen.
And so this economic inclusion was one piece of what we call programs for the people, but the most important piece. It really moved beyond just giving people a job to really how do we build equity that give people something that's more sustainable to really, you know, make a difference in terms of assets, income, and to keep people in the neighborhood with a livable wage.
The Evergreen model is a sharp break from the current playbook for down-and-out cities that prescribes tax breaks and weak regulation to attract outside investment. John Logue, founder and director of the Ohio Employee Ownership Center, has played a lead role in designing Evergreen. Logue sees employee ownership as a way to right the excesses of corporate America with its sky-high CEO bonuses and rampant outsourcing. Workers, after all, are not likely to vote to outsource their own jobs just to increase profits.
Essentially, what otherwise would have gone to the owners is going to the workers, and it's going to them fundamentally if the company is successful. The company doesn't make money, there's nothing to distribute.
If the Evergreen Cooperative works, cities across the deindustrialized Rust Belt may have a model for how to tap the wealth that poor cities already have. From Cleveland, Ohio, this is Daniel Denver for Free Speech Radio News.
Next week on FSRN's series Getting By in America's Rust Belt, where activities like urban agriculture and retooling factories for sustainable production offer some hope in the struggle to revitalize the Motor City. After recent elections in El Salvador this past March, political violence is returning to the country. The elections passed control from conservatives to a leftist party, the FMLN, which is led by former guerrillas. Some violence took place around Election Day, but now journalists and community activists are reporting an increase in threats, intimidation, and even murder, and allege that attacks are coming from right-wing extremist groups. Ricardo Martinez has more from Cabañas, El Salvador.
In June, a young anti-mining activist named Marcelo Rivera was kidnapped, tortured, and killed, some alleged by suspect death squads operating in the north-central part of El Salvador. Recently, 3 journalists working for the independent local station Radio Victoria were allegedly threatened with death for reporting on the Canadian mining company Pacific Rim. Resistance against the mining industry often comes with dire consequences. Community leaders, priests, and even a bishop were recently attacked in the north central area of El Salvador called Cabañas. Vidalina Morales is one of the leaders of the Association of Economic and Social Development of Santa Marta, ADES, a social organization working in Cabañas. This organization has also been threatened for speaking about resources.
The company wanted to start mining operations, but they couldn't get a license because the people's resistance was strong. Now the company is resorting to intimidation and violence. Along with the prominent leaders of the community, Radio Victoria has taken a strong position against the mining and has been shaping public opinion.
The local community station, Radio Victoria, is now guarded around the clock by members of the surrounding community and social activists. The station has been attacked twice in the past. Ramiro Laines, a member of the editorial team of Radio Victoria, explains the threatening calls received by his colleagues.
They threatened three of my colleagues, Vladimir Abarca from Ilo Basco, Ludwig Ereta, and Jose Beltran from San Isidro. They sent them a phone message saying, if you do not leave Radio Victoria, what happened to Marcelo is going to happen to you. Marcelo was kidnapped, tortured, and then murdered. His death resembled the torture tactics of the death squads in the 1980s Civil War. Killings of politically outspoken individuals are back again. Death squads could be back in Cabañas.
Radio Victoria is a prominent opinion leader here. Founded in 1993, Radio Victoria targets the rural and poor population in Cabañas. Their operators are young Salvadorans who were born in Honduras after their family were displaced by the Civil War. The information spread by the radio regularly contains social and community messages and criticized the injustice in the northern El Salvador. Cabañas is an area where former death squads and soldiers accused of crimes against humanity were rehabilitated, as per the peace agreement of 1992. It's also a highly conservative area where the right-wing Arena Party has the largest number of followers in the country. Lourdes Palacios is a congresswoman who works on environmental and mining issues across the country.
The death threats and violence occurring in Cabañas are aimed at intimidating communities that have had levels of autonomy, organization, and freedom of speech that are significant in our country. There are few communities like Santa Marta or Victoria with such an active voice in national life and such active participation in El Salvador's young democracy.
Others agree that the latest violence is a way to spread fear in the community, where many oppose the gold and silver mining projects. This community also sympathizes with the leftist organizations like the FMLN, an association of Friends of San Isidro. The National Civilian Police says they are investigating the recent attacks of violence, and the community organizations are preparing for national and international campaigns. They say they cannot let the civil war time come back to Cabañas. Ricardo Martinez, Free Speech Radio News, Victoria, Cabañas, El Salvador.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliates, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org, that's fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Vinod K. Jones and Catherine Comp. Our headlines editor was Jess Burns. FSRN's intern is Shuhei Nakayama, and our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. 100%